Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's Wednesday, the 19th of August, 2020. The title of this podcast is Grassroots and Astroturfing. And it follows on from a previous podcast, which was called What Can We Do? In which we extolled the virtues of grassroots community building. We didn't at that time outline many of the problems with such an idea. And we've subsequently, Anna and myself, discussed certain problems with such a project. Basically, this arose when the following day, after we'd had our initial discussions, Anna asked me, what is astroturfing? Now, the answer to this question tells us that real grassroots progressive organising can be and is subverted by big money agents of the status quo. So in this podcast then, I intend to outline how we can recognise facsimile grassroots movements, which is what astroturfing is, and suggest how we might push back against it. So astroturfing then, a little bit more by way of definition. Now, astroturf is the trade name of a real product, which is a kind of plastic grass that you can roll down on patios and across ground in order to create the facsimile of a lawn or a green and so forth. But of course, this stuff doesn't need mowing. It's very hard wearing. It's used in sports situations. And it's called astroturf. Basically what it is, it's fake grass made out of plastic. Now, there is a metaphor here, obviously, you know, between these political situations and the difference between artificial or fake grass and real grass. This actually sort of branches out, if you want it to, into some big philosophical ideas. It prompts us to think about mimesis and imitation, about truth and lies, about reality and appearance, about sophistry and dialectic. And if you go back through these podcasts, you'll find that these themes pop up over and over again as we attempt to ask more and more fundamental questions. So that difference, what can we say about it? Well, grassroots are organic and they're rooted in the lived life of individuals and communities. And they are directed against real oppressions and real discomforts, real sufferings and real injustices. They are made of flesh and blood and bone and suffering. Grassroots movements create initiatives to address real problems. And often they have a spontaneous character, at least in the beginning. They get initiated quite spontaneously from the streets, from the ground. And like real grass, they derive their substance from their roots in the earth. And they exchange metabolically with the surroundings, in the case of grass, with the air. So they take in CO2 and give out oxygen and so forth. And support ecosystems and of insects and worms and beetles and all the rest of it. So there's this deep sort of enmeshment, this deep connectivity employed by this metaphor of grassroots versus astroturf. Now, astroturf is a plastic imitation of real grass, so accordingly it has no metabolic relationship with its surroundings, as real grass does. Admirably, it doesn't need to mow in and it doesn't turn brown in dry weather. But it's a manufactured product as opposed to an organic, spontaneously arising product. So some examples of the political, propaganda, ideological astroturfing, things like the Tea Party movement in the US. Turning Point USA is another example. Turning Point UK, which is an imitation of an imitation. It's sort of a UK version of the US version. The campaign for Brexit, for some extent, had certain astroturf qualities. There's the QAnon movement. And there was some of the shenanigans that Cambridge Analytica got up to while it was an existing propaganda outfit, particularly the election in Trinidad and Tobago in 2010. Now, what I'm going to do sort of quickly is look at some of these examples, because they each in their own way have certain specifics and their own peculiar qualities. So just going through a few of them there, we can get a bit of a sense, a bit of a picture of the lie of the land in the astroturfing business. Now, what they do have in common is that billionaires finance them, whilst every effort is made to make them appear to be spontaneous movements arising from the street and peopled by ordinary people. Also, quite often, the nature of the funding of these organisations, astroturf organisations, is often deliberately concealed or obscured, and we're deflected from the true nature of the of an astroturf movement very often. So just the first example I'll deal with is the Cambridge Analytica's role in the Trinidad and Tobago election of 2010. Now, this is outlined in a Cambridge Analytica promotional video, which you can see in the film The Great Hack that came out in 2019. I think this film is available on Netflix and very well worth a watch if you can get past the background music. Now, in this campaign, Cambridge Analytica used some slogans to mobilise the youth in Trinidad and Tobago at the time of an election. Now, in Trinidad and Tobago, there are two parties, and they are ethnically based parties. There's a party that represents the Indian population of Trinidad and Tobago. By Indian, I mean people whose ancestors came or were brought by the British to Trinidad and Tobago from India, and the black population that's got its party too, and they are descendants of African slaves. Now, the Indian party, they don't know the name of the party, but they employed Cambridge Analytica to win their presidential election. And the way Cambridge Analytica went about this was to campaign in such a way as to encourage young people not to vote at all. And Cambridge Analytica boasted about its ability to change the behaviour of young people. It's actually said that we can change their behaviour, and that they aimed the campaign at young people. They used the slogan "Join the Gang," and they called it the Do So campaign, but it was actually encouraging apathy. The young people took this up, and there was graffiti for the Do So campaign around the islands, and young people were encouraged to make their own YouTube video. They were actually persuaded that it was cool not to vote. At the time, Cambridge Analytica was making 10 or so presidential campaigns like this per year. By the way, it worked. The party that had paid Cambridge Analytica did win. And in this video, that's included in The Great Hack, is actually a promo video from Cambridge Analytica itself. And one of the things that struck me is that they said on that video, "We try and increase apathy." And yet they tried to create the facsimile of a buzzing youth movement, very natural, very organic. The kids are all in it together. It's really cool. And we have to note, of course, the role of social media in this process. And there is a big question around the role of social media in these processes. I mean, particularly the way the young people were making YouTube videos and trying to get them to sort of go viral and all the rest of it. Now, Cambridge Analytica, obviously they were taking money to work for a political party, but there is billionaire money behind Cambridge Analytica. And it kind of came about, or it expanded, when Steve Bannon introduced Alexander Nix, who was the then director of Cambridge Analytica, to Robert and Rebecca Mercer. Robert Mercer's a billionaire, and Rebecca Mercer is his daughter, and she acts as his kind of spokesperson because he's a bit sort of a reticent kind of guy. I think he made a lot of money in it's a high tech in programming or something like that. It's a kind of computer waller, made absolutely billions. So and Steve Bannon, of course, who acted as the go-between here, is the guy who's built a far-right international. He acts as a go-between between the strongmen regimes in the world. He knows Le Pen in France, he knows Orban in Hungary, he knows Boris Johnson, he knows, he worked for Trump, he worked on Trump's campaign, and Trump appointed him as a part of his White House team. He also sacked him a bit later on, but Bannon travels the world trying to produce a sort of a far-right internationale, and you'll have heard me talk about him before. So we've got this kind of cabal of people with billionaire money that was behind Cambridge Analytica. Of course, Cambridge Analytica was dissolved eventually because I think its reputation collapsed when some of its more nefarious goings on came to light. I'd recommend, if you want to check up about this, Brittany Kaiser's book. It's called Targeted, and it's Brittany Kaiser's account of her time working for Cambridge Analytica. And Christopher Wiley's book, which is called Mindfuck. He worked with Cambridge Analytica in a different period after, I think he came there to Cambridge Analytica after Brittany Kaiser had left. Anyway, Cambridge Analytica characterised itself at the time, we are behaviour change agency. It's interesting that the parent company, SCL, I think Strategic Communications Laboratories, is a group with its roots in military propaganda and propaganda warfare. So there's a bit of background. But in the case of the Trinidad and Tobago election of 2010, they did produce this facsimile of a grassroots movement that seemed to have all the buzz and the fashionable energy of a genuine grassroots movement. And yet what they were doing was attempting to win the election for a particular party by producing electoral apathy in young people particularly. While we're on Cambridge Analytica, of course, we perhaps want to talk about Brexit. Cambridge Analytica had a bit of a peripheral relationship with Brexit and a contested one, but they were certainly known to, as a group, not the official campaigning group, which was called Vote Leave, but Leave EU, an organisation which still carries on. And there was a connection between Cambridge Analytica and there have been various investigations into this, and on some kind of a technicality, I think that the Commons Select Committee on technology, information technology, came to the conclusion that there wasn't really officially a connection between Cambridge Analytica and the Brexit carry-on. Later it appears that there is a connection through another company in the group called Aggregate IQ. But who knows, I don't really want to get into that here, but let us just indicate that the same kind of processes were definitely at play in the Brexit referendum. All right, we're not going to go into that too much there, but another example, the Tea Party movement. I mean, the Tea Party movement was founded in the US in 2009, and it wasn't strictly a political party, but a wing of the Republican Party. It extolled all the neoliberal bullshit, like low tax, small government, and it was vehemently against the socialisation of healthcare. It was basically followed the Buchanan, the James Buchanan neoliberal agenda. And the force behind the movement was an advocacy group called Americans for Prosperity, which was founded by David Koch, K-O-C-H. I mean, this went on to recruit 1 million members. Now, Koch Industries denies funding the Tea Party, but they did fund and found Americans for Prosperity, which was a bit of a driving force behind it. So they've given themselves a little bit of an arm's length there. And since the Tea Party was basically in the business of pushing the Buchanan neoliberal agenda, this was an agenda which the Koch brothers had financed for decades, using their vast wealth derived from big oil. And it included things like setting up think tanks like the Cato Institute, but many think tanks, a global network of think tanks, and also pretty well capturing all the economics departments in American universities, and through Buchanan starting all this off at Georgetown University. And basically, over a period of decades, making sure that young economists, up-and-coming economists, were taught that neoliberal, Hayekian, Buchananite, neoliberal economics was the orthodoxy. And they worked on this little by little, through stealth, over decades, literally over decades. So you can see there the astroturfing nature of the Tea Party movement. If you want to get a bit of chapter and verse on the Koch brothers, the role of their money, the role of Buchanan particularly, I'd get a book called Democracy and Change by Nancy MacLean. And it's excellent. Now, it's instructional that the Tea Party movement chose to name itself after the Boston Tea Party of 1773, which was a spontaneous rebellion against the British monarch, George III at the time, and who was also then, of course, the ruler of the colonies. The colonials were a long way from the mother country, and they were frontiersmen and women, and they were pretty independent-minded. And their slogan actually was "No taxation without representation," because the king was always trying to slap taxes on them. I think he put tax on tea. That's why they threw all the tea in the harbour at Boston, because it was taxed, and they think, fuck you to the king, you're not taxing us unless we can have some members of parliament. And this was a precursor to the US Revolutionary War of 1776, in which the United States gained its independence from the British Empire and the British monarch. But I'm telling you, I'm mentioning all this to outline the way in which discourse can work through historical resonances, which have symbolic significance. In this case, the Tea Party is a part of the American foundational mythos. You know, it's a part of American public discourse. Another example: Turning Point USA and UK. This is billionaire funded again, founded by one Charlie Kirk. Both Turning Point USA and UK declined to say who their current donors are, but in 2016 we know that Turning Point UK had £8 million of revenue. And the point of this again is to create a sort of a youth movement. It's to astroturf a youth movement, and it tries to persuade young people that being right wing is groovy and right on and cool. And hence it attempts to operate in universities, and it's claimed that how many student unions it's got Turning Point members as officials in student unions. Investigation shows that it exaggerates its influence. It's not exactly truthful about quite what its influence is. It runs a professor watch, prof watch, to seek out left-wing corruptors of youth, inverted commas, working on faculty in universities both in the US and in the UK. But it's manufactured, you know, it's just like throw a lot of money at it, pay a few young people and try and get something going. Interestingly, Priti Patel, current Home Secretary, Jacob Rees-Mogg, leader of the House, I think, both sort of right-wing Tories, tweeted encouraging remarks when Turning Point founded its UK chapter. Actually, on Twitter, I follow them on Twitter, and it's pretty lame. The tweets are just lacking in reason, lacking in zing. They got no wit or anything. They're just all lame is the best word to describe them. And very often they get about 4 retweets and 29 likes, and that's it. It really is a dud. And it reminds me of a similar attempt to get something going. There was a thing called Working Families for Walmart, believe it or not. And that went defunct because of a lack of transparency and an inability to arouse interest. I mean, what happens in these cases is that the organic vitality is just missing. You know, organic equals vital equals celebratory very often, and often having a carnivalesque vibe to it, even when dealing with serious matters. And that very often is missing. So there's a few examples, and you can see the kind of thing that goes down. So here's a good question for us. How to spot astroturfing? Now, I've come up with 4 procedures that are worth undertaking when you come across anything that catches your attention on social media, on the internet, in newspapers, on the TV or whatever. I'm not saying that they're exhaustive, but in the case of astroturfing, they are quite useful, I would say. First one is to research, it's to dig and to fact check. And also, try and find out who's financing your sources. And try and ascertain whether they're transparent about their underpinning ideas, their worldview. And the best sources will tell you where the writers or filmmakers or whatever they are coming from. They'll tell you that we are capitalist free marketeers, and we're going to write about stuff that interests us, and da da da. Look for that. Look for the kind of transparency as well. So the research and the digging and the fact checking doesn't stop at the particular movement you're investigating, but it also delves into the sources, and you need to try and get some sense of the trustworthiness of sources. Second, follow the money. Who's paying? Where's the money coming from? It's always interesting to follow the money, and your picture of what's going on isn't complete unless you follow the money. The third one I think is particularly powerful, and what you do is you try and ascertain the aims of the movement in question. So we're investigating Turning Point UK or Tea Party, whatever. You look at the aims of the movement, and then you ask yourself, who would benefit if these aims were realised? I'll give you an example. I went to a public meeting in the village hall at Fairbourne, which is a small coastal village just the other side of the bridge, about 3 or 4 miles from here. And this meeting was held by climate deniers, and they came to Fairbourne because Fairbourne is slightly below sea level, and it's under threat of global warming, and the local county council says they wouldn't do any further repairs on the sea defences, and consequently people living there can't sell their houses or get them insured, all this kind of thing. So it was a good place for the climate deniers to come. And now I asked myself, I sat through the most of the meeting, and I asked myself, if their ideal world, which derives from their world picture, could be realised, who would benefit? And it is obvious that who would benefit would be the Koch brothers and big oil in general. And it was very interesting because these discourses can seem radical, they seem like they're on the side of the people, they seem they're on the side of positive change. But in the end, they play into the preservation of the status quo. And that very often such discourses will appear very, very coherent. But I think you have to remember that coherence is no criterion of anything other than itself. And even whilst it can be persuasive. I mean, The Lord of the Rings is coherent, but it's fictional for all that. There is still no such thing as hobbits. There is a tragedy inherent in this kind of astroturfing. It is that, totally legitimate, ultimately sane and justifiable rage, resentment and alienation on the part of masses of people is mobilised to help preserve the status quo. The status quo, which is the very source of that rage, resentment and alienation. People are recruited into a cause of preserving their own suffering. The energy for necessary change is thereby deflected and dissipated and swallowed up eventually into a kind of nihilism. And it's a pretty kind of canny manoeuvre on the part of the status quo is to mobilise all the dissatisfaction that it itself has produced to help it to continue to exist, to preserve it. And a way to uncover that kind of thing is, as I say, is to ask who will benefit if this movement's aims are realised. Then there's a fourth thing that you need to look out for. And you need to know that astroturfing creates uncertainty. So you get front groups and fake blogs and sock puppets and so on. And a good example is that is the efforts that Big Tobacco made to exaggerate public support for smoking at the time when smoking was being exposed as a health risk. And they produced scientific-looking surveys and statistics to say, well, the public supports smoking. Later investigations showed that there was quite a bit of exaggeration going on there. Something similar happened with Microsoft, tried to produce the idea that there was a groundswell in their favour when they were being brought up for breaking antitrust laws, in other words, for having a huge monopoly. We get some environmental versions of this kind of thing. I mean, the Kochs attempted to stop wind farms off the Massachusetts coast by claiming public support for their case that this thing shouldn't happen. Obviously, they're protecting their oil business. Now, at this point, I want to consider billionaire philanthropy. Now, after this podcast I did the other day entitled What Can We Do? Somebody messaged me saying, what do you think of George Soros and the Open Society Foundations? I didn't really know that much about that. I knew about a little bit about George Soros, and I know that there is some kind of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories which put George Soros at the centre of some kind of world domination conspiracy. And also I was aware that Soros was a currency speculator, and that it claimed that in Southeast Asia some economies were brought to their knees by his speculation. And it's also asserted in various places that the crash of the pound in the late the late 90s was because Soros speculated on it and shorted it and all the rest and made billions overnight. Now there's some contestation around this. There's some denials and some claims and some controversy, and I'll leave it to you to look into it. But other than that, I wasn't all that kind of clued up. So I kind of did go and research, because I thought I'd better answer the person who's asked me this question. And it brings up the question of billionaire philanthropy. Now the question is it okay when somebody like George Soros gives to liberal, pro-justice and anti-poverty causes? And George Soros isn't financing the far right in Central Europe. On the contrary, he's kind of hated by the right and right-wing governments for supporting immigrants and for opposing the Israel government and for funding movements seeking justice after police have killed black men and so forth. So he's putting money into that kind of thing. Though this, we might argue his money was ill-gotten, because it's basically based on gambling with the economy. It's like casino capitalism. And Soros was certainly a very smart speculator. He seemed to have very good gambling skills when it comes to what the pound's going to do and all this kind of stuff. And Soros claims that he was applying Karl Popper's theory of reflexivity to markets. But is this problematic? Is it problematic? Because even though it may be that there's some kind of astroturfing going on here, but he's doing it for movements that we as radicals might want to support. I'll leave the question for the moment and perhaps say something about the Open Society Foundations. Soros has given $32 billion to these foundations, which he set up, which is the majority of his fortune. He now has a personal wealth of $8 billion, but he's given away $32 billion. It's a pretty substantial donating. I think he started out giving to programmes to help Russia and Eastern Europe establish capitalism after the Soviet Union had collapsed in the early 90s. There were a number of initiatives, and I know the American government got involved, the CIA, and God knows what, to help them to find their capitalist feet after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But I don't think it went that well. It produced an era of gangster capitalism with huge rip-offs of public assets by a very few oligarchs. It was plunder, basically. So that didn't go too well. And we have to say that Soros, for all of being right on with wanting to produce an equitable society and using his money to follow such liberal aims, but he has sent centre-right think tanks. Interestingly, he's against market fundamentalism. He doesn't think the market can do everything. This idea that he got from Popper of reflexivity claims that markets have got kind of stable phases and less stable phases, and only in the stable phase does the market obey the sort of classical patterns of as outlined by Adam Smith, and when it's unstable, it's unstable and you can't rely on it. So in that sense, he's anti-market fundamentalist. Very smart guy, now in his 90s, I think he's 90 or something like that. And he got a doctorate from the London School of Economics, obviously a long time ago, and studied under Karl Popper, the illustrious Karl Popper. In fact, the Open Society Foundation is a nod towards one of Popper's influential books called The Open Society and Its Enemies, in which he does a hatchet job on Plato and Marx, amongst others. I think he's certainly right about Plato. Plato was a or at least, unless Plato is writing ironically, we'd have to regard him as some kind of proto-fascist in his ideas of how society should be organised. So I'm still leaving this question up in the air, you know. Is it okay when somebody like George Soros gives to liberal pro-justice and anti-poverty causes? Keeping that up. Now, there is a criticism by one Nicholas Guilhot, who was a social researcher. It's 2007, and he wrote I think it's a journal called Critical Sociology, that the Open Society Foundation serves to perpetuate institutions that reinforce the existing social order, just as the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation have done before them. And he argues that control over the social sciences by moneyed interests has depoliticised this field and reinforced the capitalist view of modernisation. I've taken that from Wikipedia under the entry about the Open Society Foundations. Anyway, you can see that we can ask our question of who benefits, our cui bono question here, and it works quite well. Though in this case, you have to do substantial work to uncover what is going on and to substantiate a view like Guillot's on this matter. So, the who benefits question can sometimes take a little bit of digging. And so I've left the question still up in the air, is it okay when somebody like George Soros gives his money to what we would regard as good causes? Maybe they're kind of reforming causes rather than revolutionary causes, but nevertheless, who would not want money given to good, solid and effective poverty alleviation projects? Obviously, we'd prefer Soros to not to be financing far-right astroturfing of the most kind of crass kind. However, we cannot regard billionaire philanthropy of this type as unproblematic, in that it places the disposal of a lot of power and assets at the whim of one person. Why should it be? Why should the fate of millions of people be at the whim of a few billionaires, Bill Gates and George Soros? There might be wanting to prevent injustice, etc., but injustice is present there right at the foundational moment, and they are bound to place conditions on what they do. They're going to choose where that money goes, and God knows there are a million good causes. And it may be that sticking plasters and producing palliatives rather than cures could itself be problematic. I would also say that single billionaires donating huge sums to good causes legitimates the Thatcherite notion that charity is better than rational, socially organised safety nets and anti-poverty initiatives, etc. These, at the end of the day, need to become matters of collective consideration and decision making. All right, in conclusion, astroturfing is sometimes crass and obvious, and without the vitality of organic movements, it can fail to gain traction. There are less pure types of astroturfing in which a facsimile is produced by a genuine, initially radical movement, and that some of the energy of such a radical movement is appropriated. When suddenly Boris Johnson got some kind of some socialism as the COVID-19 pandemic kicked off, people would say, "Oh, he's parking his tanks on Labour's lawn, or he's stealing their thunder." So the tests that I've outlined are therefore important, and I'd say to you, when you come across something that looks appealing and looks sensible, try and determine if the status quo is served by it, or would be served by it if its ambitions were realised, or whether it makes possible some progress if it was successful. Ask yourself that question. That's the prime question. Also, follow the money. Also, do your research. Dig a little deeper. Not only finding sources, but checking those sources themselves. And a good clue there is to look for transparency. And perhaps don't be too fazed by people who are coming from a place you yourself wouldn't come from. If there's transparency, you will possibly find something useful to your arguments and your understanding. Also note that the surface of the status quo can actually change radically. Remember we distinguished in the previous podcast, the one entitled What Can We Do, between the core of a conservative ideology and the surface. So the surface of a status quo might change radically. It can look very radical. Nazism looked very radical. But capitalism and its class relationships were protected in that case, and in other cases like it. And you can find genuine energy, even when there is astroturfing, though it's made misdirected into a dead end, into the dead end of, in the case of fascism, of a notion of death before dishonour. And you know that you will burn everything, you'll burn the world rather than admit that you were wrong. But that is a matter for another podcast. We will, I can promise you, at some future time, consider crowds and power and mass psychology and how resentment and rage and alienation and general disgruntlement resulting from a terribly inefficient system can be mobilised by forces which would preserve that system. In other words, which would preserve the cause of the alienation, disgruntlement, rage itself. Thanks for listening.